Are you sure you want to stay here? It looks creepy.
But Savannah, this is the House of Mystery. Let's see, the brochure says true crime, conspiracy, alternate history, all rooms right here in the house.
I don't know, which room is ours?
Yes, this may be our room. Oh, well, sorry, ma'am. Obviously, this is not our room. Ah, here's our room. True crime.
You have now entered into the House of Mystery, the best in true crime, conspiracy, and alternative history, with Al Warren and Kevin Thompson. KCAA, the stations that leave no listener behind. Broadcasting on 1050 AM, 102.3 FM, and 106.5 FM. The trifecta of talk radio for Southern California.
Okay, so now, on to a more serious note. We've got the D.B. Cooper case solved.
No.
Well, we don't know. We're going to find out.
Yes.
So we have with us Vern Jones, and the book we're talking about is D.B. Cooper and Me. It's A Criminal, A Spy, My Best Friend. And Carl Lauren is the author, and I'm guessing that he was his friend, so we'll find out. So welcome to the show, Vern.
Thank you.
So tell me about the premise of this then. Now Carl is the author. Now, so Carl was the friend of D.B. Cooper, or who he said was D.B. Cooper?
Yes, he met him back in the 50s, actually. They were... Carl and his other friends started one of the first parachute teams in the nation. Recreational parachuting wasn't popular back then, and he had just gotten out of the military as a paratrooper, and they really liked jumping, so they started jumping at a small airport north of Detroit. And his friend, what soon became his friend, Walter Recca, read about them in the newspaper and came up and joined them. So that was when they first met, and Walter actually introduced Carl to his wife, to Carl's soon to be wife at that point. So
when this story was brought to you, what was your initial feeling? Like, were you thinking, oh, it's just another D.B. Cooper thing, or how did you feel?
That's a good question. The way it evolved is one of our editors, our publishing company, Principia Media, and one of our editors came to our director of publishing and said, my uncle has this book that he's been working on for a long time, and he really wants to work with a small publisher that he can trust. And so, as our procedure is, Dirk then called Carl and spoke with him for a while, and I had no idea what the story was about at that time. And after Dirk spoke with him for over an hour, Dirk called and said, you really should talk to this guy. And I said, what's the story about? And he told me it was his best friend, D.B. Cooper. And I said, you don't believe this nut job, do you? And I'm incredibly skeptical. My education is in sciences. And I thought it was crazy. And Dirk said, let's just give him a call and see what you think. And so I did call him in 2016, right around the 1st of February when I called him. And I talked to him, and he didn't seem like a nut job. He seemed like he was credible, and some of the things that he was telling me were just, he said, you really got to come see all my evidence at my house. As a matter of fact, it was on April 1st. My wife and I were passing through that area, and so I told my wife, I said, just, you know, she was going to stay at the hotel with our dog that we travel with. And she said, I'll stay here. And I said, I'll probably be back in a little over an hour. And over 5 hours later, I came back, and at that point, I said, I don't know if he's Cooper, but what he did after this is really a good story. So we really kind of started pursuing this on the premise that what he did after the hijacking was really the story that we thought was compelling, because I thought there was no way in the world he would ever convince me that it was Cooper. So I visited him that day, and then a couple weeks later, our filmmaker and I went down to just take some pictures and stuff, and the filmmaker looked over in this plastic tray in his trailer where he kept all of his evidence, and there were audio tapes there. And he said, "What are on those audio tapes?" And he just said, really casually, "Well, those are the discussions that we had between Walter and I about the hijacking." So it turns out there was over almost 3.5 hours of audio tapes. Much of the time, they're talking about the hijacking and some of his other very dangerous escapades after that. And that's what started me thinking, man, there's probably more to this. And so then we actually hired a private investigator, Joe Koenig, who was the lead investigator for the Jimmy Hoffa case. And he is a forensic linguist who's written books about it and speaks all over the nation on linguistics. We hired him to actually analyze the audio tapes to see if he noticed any deception in Walter's voice as he's telling the story. And then we had him analyze Carl. He interviewed Carl for, I think, almost 9 hours.
Wow.
Just trying to get through it. And then we also have an eyewitness, believe it or not, that saw Walt within an hour of the plane leaving SeaTac on that night, and he was very credible. So the farther we went, actually, when we got to that point, which was, about 7 months later, when Joe said, "This guy is telling the truth." Now, there's a difference. A linguist can only tell, and Joe's quick to tell you, he can't tell you if it's factual, but he can say, "This person is telling the truth. He believes exactly what he's saying." Just the evidence kept piling up, and then we found out that he had not only confessed to Carl over these years, and this was not his confession to Carl was not a deathbed confession. It started in around the year 2000 and went almost to the time of Walter's death in 2014. And so they had frequent conversations. And Carl's wife listened in on many of these because, she was friends with Walter also. And so it's just this preponderance evidence that just keeps compiling, and finally you say, "My gosh, I really think it is." Actually, Joe, in his conclusions, he finally said a few months ago, probably 3 or 4 months ago, said that, "I am totally convinced that he was Cooper." So that was kind of how this all evolved as far as getting through the evidence and evaluating. But certainly the most surprising thing to me about this whole project was that I finally believed that he was Cooper.
So what do you find that's different about this and that the readers will get different in this book than all the other theories and books out there?
Yeah, there's a lot of good researchers. As a result of this, I was kind of a casual follower of the Cooper thing. I mean, it was the hijacking occurred my first year of college, which, was somewhat of a blur, but that was when it happened. So every time a documentary would come out, I'd want to watch it or something like that. But I was not an avid follower of it. But obviously, since this book came to us, we've been just going through all the FBI files, all the other books, the documentaries, the movies, the docudramas. We just keep watching as many, just investigating as much as we can. And there, none of the other Coopers suspects some of them had deathbed confessions to one person, but Walter actually confessed to, his niece. He actually dictated a confession, and so his niece heard, his sister heard it, Carl heard his confession, Loretta heard it, So it wasn't just one kind of, oh, by the way, I'm D.B. Cooper. And the detail and everything is quite interesting, even though these conversations were, you know, that all the tape recordings were 37 years later. Obviously, he doesn't remember all the details, because after this, he boarded hundreds of flights and did things that were certainly more illegal and probably more dangerous than this. So the confessions are certainly one thing. The eyewitness was, it was almost inconceivable to me that we found this man. What helped was on the tapes, when Walter and Carl were talking about it in 2008, Walter said that after he jumped, he did fracture his leg in a jump, and he was walking to a light that he saw. And I've only had one skydive in my life. I did it because I just last year, because I better do it if I don't talk about this at all. But Carl Lauren, he had hundreds of jumps, and they jumped in the winter in Michigan, and at night they jumped literally every weekend for about the 6 years that team was together. And he tells me that when you jump at night, if it's overcast skies, he says it's like jumping into a tunnel. You have no idea. And you might pick up just noises. You might pick up like a light or something like that. But he said you never see the ground. You hit something before you hit the ground before you even see it, so there's no way to brace for it. So it's real common to get injured in a night jump. But anyway, he said he saw this light, and so he just proceeded to, well, first he took off his parachute. The money was tied around his neck in a drawstring bag. It's a bank bag. He asked for a knapsack, but he got a bank bag. And so he ended up tying it around. He used the shroud lines from one of the parachutes there. He cut it open, or he cut them off, and he tied it around between his legs and around his neck. Then he had an overcoat, and he put the overcoat on over top of the money and put his belt around that, and then put the parachute on. So that was how he jumped. And so when he landed, he took off the parachute, just stuffed it in the backpack for the chute, and put some branches over top of it. And then he took his trench coat off, or his overcoat, and he put the money inside that because he knew it would look very suspicious to be walking with a bank bag at night. And so he wrapped his coat around this, and then used his belt around that on top of it, and then tucked it under his arm. And that was how he walked, and it was freezing rain. And he walked for a little over a mile. He got to the light he saw was kind of a truck stop thing. It was it had gas pumps. It had a little counter there, and it was a kind of a cafe. As a matter of fact, it was called the TNOA Junction Cafe. And they didn't serve alcohol, and they stayed open until 11 at night, or midnight, I'm sorry, and without serving alcohol. So that was where he went. And he walked in, and he saw a guy there that he called Cowboy. And he said he was the only one in the cafe. And he said he walked in, and he noticed that, well, the guy was dressed in all cowboy gear. He said, cowboy hat, cowboy boots. And the next room, he had a guitar. And so he had no idea where he was. And he called his friend in Seattle and asked him to come get him. And he had told his friend about that he was going to do this, but they were both so drunk, his friend didn't remember it, he said. But he called his friend, and he didn't know where he was, so he asked Cowboy if he would give this guy directions. And so he did. And then Don came down and picked him up and drove him back to his house in Heartland. So that was a pretty good description. Well, the other thing that Walt said was this cowboy, as he left, he drove away in a dump truck.
A dump truck?
Yes, a dump truck. And so when Carl went out to try to find this guy, he thought, well, where would I look? Well, I'll check, you know, someplace that might work on trucks. And so he went to a gas station that had a towing service, and he asked the owner there, who was a young guy, he said, did he have anyone that fit this description? He said he's you know, he dressed like a cowboy. He obviously was a singer because he was going to a gig that night, and he drove a dump truck. And he said, well, no, I don't, but let me ask around to the older guys around town. And Carl went back. He lives in Florida. He went back to Florida, and he got a call a couple of days later, and the guy said, I think I found your guy. And so the guy's name is Jeff Osadich, and Jeff was a former police officer. As we checked out Jeff in the town, we went to the newspaper, talked to one of the guys in the newspaper office and said, what do you know about this guy? And he said, well, why do you want to know? And I said, well, we think he witnessed something, but, you know, and he said, if it's Jeff Osadich, if that's who saw it, he said, you couldn't have found a better witness. he said he's so highly respected, and it turns out he really is, his whole family is. And so we talked to Jeff, and Jeff said the first time he talked to Carl, he said, I remember something that happened. He said, I know it was somewhere around Thanksgiving, but he described it because he said, I'm a police officer, and the guy was really suspicious. And he wasn't a police officer at the time. He was, it was a small town called Rosalind, and they had actually closed down their sheriff's office and became part of the county. And so he said, I watched him. He said, of course, the bundle under his arm was very, very distinctive. And then he actually told us, he said, I saw him walking alongside the road when I was driving down here, but this was not my dump truck. It was my employer's, and we couldn't pick up hitchhikers. And as a matter of fact, they had taken the passenger seat out. And so he said, I saw him, and I felt bad I couldn't pick him up. But then he came in, and he said, now this guy was so suspicious. He had no idea where he was. He said his car broke down. And you'd think, you know, if you were driving a car, you'd have an idea where you were. And so anyway, it just was all such a strange thing. And he said, you know, then the guy paid for my coffee, and I left. So his description of Walt and the encounter that happened was very credible. And to this day, he's still alive, by the way. He's very articulate, and he's in the documentary, you'll actually hear him speaking too.
Just for the listeners that aren't familiar with the D.B. Cooper case, because, I mean, it is a rather old case, you really caught my attention with the way you described that he wrapped the money around him. But just to refresh our memories, how much money was it?
It was $20,000. I'm sorry, $200,000.
Yeah, I started to say there's a big difference there.
It's like $1.2 million in today's currency.
So how did he know to wrap the... Because as I'm listening to the way that he wrapped the money around him and jumped with, you know, military precision, and I say that because my brother is a jump master, and you can tell by all the screws and metal in his back now. And what you said was exactly true. If you're jumping at night and you're jumping, if there's fog, clouds, anything, I mean, you're hitting something before you're landing on something. And that's exactly the way he describes it. But it's almost like he did it with military precision. You know, you've got all of this money, which is added weight,
right?
But he knew how to hang it. Did he have any type of military training, or was he just, you know?
The answer is yes. Walter was an Army paratrooper, and then he was discharged, and then he joined the United States Air Force as a rescue and survival specialist.
Mm-hmm.
He literally made hundreds of jumps by this time. He jumped up in Alaska. He jumped in Labrador into icy waters. We actually have newspaper clippings of all of these things and his military record. He was actually decorated some of the things that he did when he was he worked for the United States Air Force in rescue and survival. He was assigned to the Thunderbirds, and they did a mission down to South America. And then he also participated in the Berlin airlift. So he was very experienced with jumping. He was he was very familiar with the drop zones out in near the Seattle area. He was registered with the United States Parachuting Association. He was the 99th person to be on their registry. And the weird thing is that, you know, people are talking that there are quite a few usual suspects. And, you know, once in a while, if you read an article, say the top 10 suspects. Walter wasn't on that. The FBI claimed that their search focused on experienced parachutists. And they interviewed, all of the suspects were on there. But the one person they didn't interview was Walter. As a matter of fact, the guy who picked him up, his friend Don, who drove from Seattle, was a fire jumper. That's how they got to know each other. They met up in Alaska as fire jumpers. And they interviewed him, but they didn't interview Walt.
Yeah, why the difference?
We have theories. I don't know. I can't speak for the FBI. They're not talking about it, and they aren't accepting anything. The only thing they have said that they would accept is physical evidence, such as one of the $20 bills or the parachute.
The $20 bill, I can see, yeah. But the parachute, I mean, come on. There's thousands of those.
Oh, yeah. You know, the funny thing, when we went out to Clay Elum area, people use parachutes for weird things out there. You know? They really do. They use them for covers, for wood. They use it, if they, you know, it's kind of...
To cover cars?
Yeah, stuff like that. For kids, for hammocks, you know, it's just weird things. So, but yeah, those are the two things that they said. And quite honestly, I'm kind of surprised Walt didn't keep one of the 20s, because he kept lots of stuff. He kept the underwear. He wore bottoms of long underwear. He kept those. He gave them to Carl. And so I was so certain that he would keep a 20. I looked through all the cleats and everything in these long underwear, but I sure can't find it if it's there. But toward the end of his life, he had some caregivers who took a lot of money from him, and I don't know this, but it was just, if he did, there's a good chance that they, like, he kept his immunization records from the military. Who does that, you know?
Well, you never know when they'll come in handy. It's more handy than the underwear. I mean,
yeah, since he was about 100, I don't know what he said, 160 pounds, 170 pounds, something like that, when he, at that age. And when he died, he was about 300 pounds. So he jokes on the tape. He says, they don't fit me anymore.
But the weight is important. You know, if you're going to jump, a parachute can only carry so much. And like my brother, now I have to keep referring to my brother, you know, now I will rappel out of a chopper, no problem. I have the security of that rope. But jumping out of a plane, heck no. But my brother says that whenever you jump, you're carrying about 200 pounds of gear, and it's between your legs, and as soon as you get ready to hit the ground, you release it, because that weight's going to hit the ground first, and then you're not as heavy when you hit. And the way you described him jumping and the way he tied it off, it tells me military all over, you know.
Yes, yeah, that it is. It is military procedure. You're exactly right. Yeah. Get the parachute out of sight as soon as possible. But that's exactly what he describes.
Now, the one thing that has always come up in every documentary that I watch about this, though, is that there were 20s that were found in a local river.
Right. Yeah, at the Tenabar, down the Columbia River. That's, we don't know how it got there. What we do know is that on the audio tapes that Walter talks about when his friend Don came down. Don was kind of a petty thief, if you would. He didn't, as Carl knew Don also, and Carl said, he didn't really like rob banks or anything, but you wouldn't leave your wallet out. So he said that. So he had had some brushes with the law, and so Don came and picked him up, and so Walt took, he said his words, a few bundles out of the bag, and put him in Don's coat and said, there, now you're part of this. And Walt reports that Don said, you know, the prisons are full of people like you and I. That was around. But he did give Don some money. And Don, Walt and Carl are talking about it in the audio tapes. And Don was really paranoid. The FBI did come, as I mentioned, they interviewed him. And he was afraid to do anything with that money. So we do know that Don lived in Seattle. And then he moved down to Olympia a few months before the money was found at Tenenbaum. So if there's a connection, I don't know. It's the best guess that I have, but it is purely a guess. I have no evidence of it whatsoever.
Do we know kind of what the purpose of this was? Like, why did he do it?
He wanted the money. He was tired of being poor.
Yeah.
Well, so am I.
Well, that's what I mean. It's kind of an elaborate scheme, if you will. Like, it's kind of, okay, so I need money, and most people that are, you know, you're going to do something illegal, it's rob a bank seems to be popular, or things like that. So this is kind of like, okay, well, how about if I do this? This is a little bit elaborate to think of, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it was, but Carl says that after these guys got done jumping, Walter did rob a restaurant in Detroit. Unsuccessfully, he was captured as soon as he walked out the door, as a matter of fact. it wasn't much of a getaway. So he was arrested, and they were going to, you know, so he was in there, and he was working for the Teamsters as an enforcer at that time. and so the Teamsters bailed him out, but at that time, he was fired immediately because they said, "We can't. You're a felon. We can't have anything to do with you anymore," which was quite common practice, according to Joe Koenig. He said they don't dare because it's so easy to get those people to turn after you arrest them for something.
The Teamsters said that?
Yeah, they bailed him out of jail, and then he immediately jumped bail, and that was his first trip out to Washington. He left Michigan and went out there. That was the first time he moved out there. But, so he had that knowledge. But Carl said that when they were, after they were jumping, they would all sit around and drink beer and tell stories. And so he said that every once in a while, Wallace kept saying, you know, I think the best way to do a robbery would be to do it on to rob an airplane, is the way he said it. Obviously, that was in the 50s, the late 50s, so he hadn't thought this out thoroughly. But he talked about it then. And when Carl asked Walt on this, he said, well, how did you come up with that? And he said that he had watched some show on television, and it was about these guys that demanded, they were in a bank, and so they demanded a getaway car, and then they demanded an airplane, and they said, I thought I could just cut out all that other stuff by just doing it on the airplane. But he said
good point.
He was really sick of being poor. He worked on the Grand Coulee Dam, actually. He's a welder. He's a really mediocre welder. That's by all reports. His friends would say he's really a mediocre welder. But he worked there just kind of periodically. He wasn't really... he was with the iron workers, but he wasn't... He was just kind of like an apprentice, I understand.
So he can't weld, and he can't rob a bank, so he's going to...
You'll notice that it didn't require precision welding to get out of the plane, right?
Yeah. So, kids, remember that. Whatever you're failing at, there's always something you're going to be good at.
Yeah, he was definitely good at a lot of things, that's for sure.
Yeah, so what do we know about the rest of his life after the jump and the all that? What did you find out about how he lived after that?
Well, this is what we know. Well, first of all, what Walt said was that he had been, back in the early 60s, Walt actually applied to the CIA.
Oh,
well, there you go.
Actually, in 1962, he made a trip out to Elsinore, California, which is a pretty famous drop zone. And because he was told that that was where the CIA recruits from. And so he did that in 62, and in 1963, he took a test. Well, in 62, when he was there, he met this guy that became his friend for the rest of his life. We have his full name, but we're pretty sure that he was one of Walter's handlers for the rest of his life, so we call him Philip Q. But I told you Walter kept things. He kept diaries, so we have literally phone numbers, bank account numbers, things that we couldn't ever disclose or show anyone. But they're all in this little thing. And this Phil, his name shows up repeatedly all over the world, Warsaw, Saudi Arabia, Montreal, Indonesia, and all where Walter's passports, we have all of his passports, match him up being shortly before that or shortly after that. So he applied to the CIA September 18th of 63 is when he got his reply, and they basically said, we cannot at this time utilize the qualifications which you've made available to us. So he didn't get the job with them, and that was in 63. And Carl really thinks that was when he just said, my life's just going really bad, because it was in 65 that he robbed the restaurant. So he had that connection with that, and then January 1st of 1971, 11 months before the hijacking, this Phil got him a job at Bunnell Corporation there in Seattle. And so in addition to the part-time job he did at the dam welding, he did some just small assignments for this new employer, Bunnell Corporation, which they actually brag about in some of their literature that that one vice president from Bunnell said, we're not mercenaries. Mercenaries kill people. We hire people to do that. And so that was his first, but on his resume, on Walt's resume, which is quite strange, because this resume that I have in front of me was the place of issue was Dahran, Saudi Arabia, and it was compiled by the Consulate General of the United States of America. I don't know who does your resume, but they don't do mine. but it shows there that he worked with Bunnell from 71 to 74. But Walt said that a couple of months after the hijacking, he was working at a site, and these two guys that he had never seen before with hard hats came up and said, do you want to have a beer after work? Well, that was always a key phrase for Walt. He don't think he ever turned one down. And so he met him at the Brown Derby out in Spokane. And Walt said he sat down. These two guys came in. They all ordered beers. And after the waitress brought the beer and went back, the one looked at him and said, do you want to go to prison for the rest of your life?
And Walter.
They actually used his real name, which was Walter Pica. That was what he was born with, Walter Pica. But since 65, he was going by Walter Reca, R-E-C-A. And so Walt, of course, said no. And then they said, then you work for us. And they got up and left. And he asked around at the work site with the union and said, you know, who were those two new guys that were there yesterday? And they said there weren't new guys yesterday. And he explained the situation that these guys had, you know, bought a beer and then walked out. And the guy said, I can assure you they're not iron workers. And Walt said, well, how can you assure me of that? And they said, we don't know one, let alone two iron workers who would leave a beer on the table. So that was their explanation.
True.
So from that point on, this is a guy who had an eighth grade education. He did speak, he was raised in a family that spoke Russian and Polish. And so he spoke that fluently. And so from that point on, Walt said to Carl that they would send him, he would get tickets to different cities, and he would take these flights and go through training. And he kind of described the training to Carl, you know, basically observations and stuff like that. And then so this guy who had, like I said, an eighth grade education, really a mediocre welder at best, he got his first passport under his assumed name, Walter Recca. He hadn't changed his name legally yet. And from that point on, he went to over 30 countries, starting in 1974, and his passports have him literally going all over the world until up to 1985. And he described to Carl that his job was to kill people. That's what he did. And he estimated that he killed over 20 people. And he said they were all really bad people. They all deserved to die. And a couple of them are names that would be recognized. So.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, now, you can't drop us off at the corner like that.
Yeah.
I'm worried about talking too long. I mean, you see, there's just so much. It's crazy. When we first started talking to Carl, it's like, Carl, you got to just answer the question. You can't. And now I'm doing the same thing. So I apologize, guys.
No,
that's fine. Now we know. Now we know. Well, that's okay. So
yeah.
Now, I see that you also are like the publisher. Like that's who you are. You're an author, and your Principia is your media company.
Right, Principia. Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about that. How? What's that about?
That started in 2011 when I wrote my first book, and I submitted it to publishers, and the I got some offers back from the publishers, but I. And my real job, the one we've had since 1989, and that I read a lot of government contracts, federal regulations, and stuff like that. So I was just reading these contracts they offered, and I thought, well, this is crazy. Who in their right mind would sign this contract? And so I told my agent, I said, I'm not going to sign this. And he said, well, they're all going to be like that. And he was right. They all come out the same. Format. And so I said, well, we can do better than that. We, especially for new and emerging authors, it's a really bad deal for most of them. And so I did it. I said, I knew we can do it better, and so we do. And so we work with very few authors, but that's intentional. In the last 2 years, very, very few, because this has just been so totally time-consuming. So when we select to work with an author, all of our authors make money on their books, and they get into it with the partnership that we have. They maintain all their rights, and so that's kind of the arrangement that we have with most of them. We try to make sure that they go into this with their eyes wide open and know exactly what they're getting into, and then that's kind of how it all started.
What do you guys mainly publish? Like, true crime, or what's kind of your subjects?
I've never published a true crime before. It's very diverse, actually. I published a collection of stories by the former, the head police officer at the Michigan State Police, Bob Muldor. He's a really really good memoir that he wrote. We wrote a book on sustainability. We published it. We published with Joe Koenig's book, Getting the Truth, which is now used as a teaching tool. And he even at the FBI. So it's just really diverse group of books. But the one thing in common is that they're good stories, and the people, the authors that we work with, are willing to take advice, coaching, and then we work with really good artists on the interior design and editors and proofers. So that's kind of what we do here.
Oh, that sounds good. Very interesting. So now with D.B. Cooper here, what is it that convinced you, you being a skeptic and all, what made you jump over the fence to deciding this was the true story?
It was literally it was a time where I really started leaning was when Jeff Osadich, explained to us his meeting with Walter. And then we started thinking, my goodness, this is, but really, I think the answer to the question is when we had Joe evaluate, and it's fascinating watching him evaluate and how he tells, you know, what he's looking for as far as truth. And his specialty, he's a certified fraud examiner, and so he's really good at finding embezzlers and stuff of that nature. But he, watching him analyze what Jeff said and his discussion with him and how Joe is so thorough, and when he came back and said, Vern, this is classic truthful statement. And that was really when I said, my God, I think we have Cooper. That's crazy. So, but that was literally the moment when I said, yeah, let's keep digging into this. And if we find something that disputes any of this, then we give it up. But until then, that's what really got us. We literally traveled all over the country interviewing people. And we found a guy that Walter bought the house from just after the hijacking. And he paid cash to a guy in Spokane. The guy was kind of a house flipper, and he's still alive. He lives in Kentucky, and we interviewed him at length. And he too, is just, every time Joe looks at these, he makes transcripts and analyzes the transcript, and he just said, this guy's truthful. And it was quite impressive.
So how's the D.B. Cooper Club reacting to the book, and what kind of things are they saying?
It's been kind of interesting. They're really, most of their stories, and the way I describe it is that most of their stories kind of evolve around just the 6.5 hours that he was on the plane, you know, and did he remember this? And so Walter doesn't, you know, he's telling the story literally 37 years later, after traveling all over the world and flying literally around the world many times. So they said, well, did he remember this? And it's like, if he did, he didn't say it. You know, and why didn't he say that? Well, I don't know why he didn't say it, you know. And one of the things that that really bothered them, and it's understandable, is that Walter said that he initially went to the side door of the plane, and then the stewardess said, well, why don't you use the back door? And he said, well, yeah, that's good. Well, the reports from the FBI are that they literally boarded the plane from the aft or rear stairs. And so why would he not immediately go to that? And so that was a question that we had, too. And we didn't have to put it in the book, and we didn't have to put it in the documentary, but we decided to because he said, listen, this is the evidence that we have. So, and that's what he said. So they're saying, well, that doesn't even make sense. So I'm thinking, you know, if I want to make excuses for him, I can say, you know, well, he was probably pretty darn nervous walking into the jet to begin with. And then Carl's a commercial pilot also for years. And Carl said, well, I would have never guessed those back stairs opened. No other plane did. And he said, the other thing is we always jumped on the side of a plane. So that might be the explanation, but again, it wasn't something that Carl ever asked Walter. But they clearly spoke about it, and so we thought, okay, fine, we're gonna put it in the book,
yeah.
And you can, you know, take question of it, but that's okay. You know, we have a lot of other evidence, but that's kind of one of the things that bothered them. They didn't like it that Walter wasn't on the list of all the FBI agents or FBI's, you know, suspects. But the funny thing is, all of theirs were, and the FBI discounted every one of them.
Yeah.
So, you know, they chose not to interview Walter. Why? I can guess, but I don't know because I can't speak for them, but I have suspicions, certainly.
Yeah, yeah. Well, now, so this is going to be a documentary as well, right?
Yes, it is.
And tell us about that. When does it come out?
Yeah. It will be, there's going to be a premiere out in Cle Elum, Washington, and the premiere will be on July 14th. Yeah, it's a Saturday, July 14th. at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and it's going to be a benefit that we're doing for all the firefighters. Clay Elum almost burned, as you, I'm sure you guys are aware. It was really close to the city last year.
Yeah.
And so we wanted to do something for Clay Elum and for the firefighters. So there's literally all proceeds are going directly to the firefighters.
Wow, that's great. We'll link that as well as the book on the webpage and everything. Wow. So there we go. We know D.B. Cooper. it's been fascinating. We'll get your website up as well for the publishing. So our guest has been Vern Jones, and we've got the D.B. Cooper case solved. So everyone pick up the book, go out and see the documentary, actually, if you are in the area, and support the firefighters. Thanks for being on the show.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you for being on.
Welcome to Stephen's True Crime Commentary. Discussions of forensics, how it's done, and true crime interest.
Welcome back to Stephen's True Crime Commentary. I am Stephen David Lampley. All right, listen, we're going to continue our discussion of blood spatter today with part three of the forensics of blood spatter analysis. Now, there are handouts available on this blood spatter series. If you go to www.stephendavidlampley.com/handouts with an S, StephenDavidLampley.com/handouts. You'll see the handout there. We have made special preparations for this to be very user-friendly. You can read it online and follow along with us, or you're welcome to print it out. We have made it printer-friendly with margins. It is friendly for black and white or color printers, so feel free to do as you wish with those. Okay, so let's start this discussion with area of convergence. Now, the area of convergence is the starting point of the blood before it hit the surfaces of the crime scene. Simplified, it is the taking of the blood spatter on the crime scene surfaces and then determining where the blood source was located when the spatter occurred. Now, in detail, and this is on the handout as well, in detail, it involves investigators determining the angle from which each droplet of blood hit the object by using strings to project that angle outward into space. Now, by doing this with each blood droplet, a common point will begin showing itself as the strings begin to meet at a common focal point out in that space. This is what is called the area of convergence. It shows where the victim was located when the spatter occurred. Now, we know that's how investigators identify the victim's location during the blood spatter. Let's discuss some of the common blood stain patterns. And these are also on the handout. Arterial spatter. Now, when an artery is severed, it typically spurts out blood under pressure by the heartbeat pressure. Arterial patterns have a specific and distinctive pattern. Typically, they're arched with multiple areas created from each beat of the heart. It's a very, very distinctive pattern. Another pattern is what we call cast-off, and that is created by blood that is deposited on a weapon, such as a hammer or club. When there is blood on an object and the object is swung, it can throw off or cast off some of the blood that is on the object onto surrounding surfaces. Now, this, of course, is called a cast-off pattern. The direction that the object was swung can be determined by the spatter pattern it leaves. And by counting the number of arched patterns, we'll reveal the number of strikes that were hit on the victim. Another pattern is what we call a wipe pattern. A wipe pattern is simply created by an object that is moved through an existing stain and leaving a wipe pattern behind. And we have something called a pattern transfer, and it is created when blood comes in contact with another object and then some of the blood transfers or is wiped off, if you will, onto that object. We have something called a body image pattern. Now, this occurs when a body has been lying on the ground or on the floor or some object, and the blood pools around the body, creating a pattern showing the position of where the body was lying. All right, we are out of time again. I hope you were able to take something away from this today. I hope you learned something. We will be back next time with part 4 of the Blood Spatter series. I look forward to talking to you then.
Thank you for tuning into Stephen's True Crime Commentary, heard across America. You are invited to visit Stephen's website for information on his books, speaking dates, and speaking programs like How to Catch a Liar. In this seminar, Stephen explains some of the very same techniques police detectives use to help them determine if someone is lying. You will learn such things as global versus individual indicators, use of contractions, voice tone, eye shift, evasion, allusion, pronoun usage, question pause, base shift, and much more. Go to StephenDavidLampley.com for information on this seminar and much more.
Stephen's True Crime Commentary is a production of Something Weird Media and West 53rd Productions, with music by JasonLampley.com.
To find out more about our show, guests, or listen to a previous show, visit our website at www.somethingweirdmedia.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.